I'm a little extra weirded out.
Yeah, you've been weirdy.
Yeah. Forcing myself.
Yeah, I can tell.
Okay.
What should we go with first again?
I think we're going to start with just the general idea of books. Today.
Let's just go. Let's figure it out. We're good at this.
Okay. I would hardly.
Nope.
We're good at this.
Right.
We're going to cut that out.
Okay.
No one's going to hear that.
Hello, I'm John.
I'm John.
And you're watching the 226.
Today we're talking about books.
Reading in general.
We each thought of about 10 or 15 books that we really love, we've read, or that we want to read. And we kind of gathered them here over here. If you're watching the video, you can see we've got a couple stacks of books over here.
It's kind of ridiculous, really.
And I think we've been putting this episode off for just a little too long. Cause
I think so, too.
We talk about books that we're reading all the time in all of these other episodes that we've done so far. But even just reading in general is something I'm trying to get in the habit of doing, especially at the end of last semester when I was so used to reading all of this academic material for classes. I finished that semester and then I realized I had so much more free time during the Christmas break. And I started pushing myself to read a chapter of a book every day, but to be in the middle of three or four different books at the same time. So it kind of gives me the variety that I like without having to force myself to go all the way through one particular book. But it also makes me disciplined as well, trying to stay on track and finish books on time as well. So.
Yeah. I think these books are a little bit easier to read than that academic stuff you're reading.
Yeah,
too. I read some of that, and holy cow.
There's
quotes or like citations every two words or something.
Yeah, and it was honestly an interesting transition when I went from all of the academic stuff to one of the books we'll talk about later by Ken Robinson on creativity in schools, where I'm so used to seeing the citations in the text just giving evidence for this is why this is true. And I'm so used to writing that in my own things as well that not seeing that there every time he said that, I was like almost trying to challenge it. Like, I don't know. Like, where do you have any backing for that or any proof or anything? It was just a weird transition for me, but I got over it and it was pretty neat.
Nice. I think the fact that we talk about all these books very often in these podcasts really speaks to the power of reading and how much it means to both of us.
Yes.
I can remember a day before I really like read and got into books that I was thinking, okay, what have I learned at school? And what do I want to learn? And a lot of the stuff I want to learn, I'm not going to learn in classes.
Yeah.
And it was just like, well, books are the way I do that. And then it was just this light bulb that went on, like, Jonathan, why aren't you reading? So I just started reading and I really love it. I think it's fantastic.
Do you find yourself getting better at it as you go?
Yeah. Better as in like faster, more comprehension, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. My practice makes perfect usually. I just think it's great you can get into so many topics just by reading. And I love reading things that will make me more knowledgeable. Maybe not necessarily like any fantasy or fiction, but I love reading like nonfiction and what people think about things.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, which I would say is most of the books on this table.
I think most of those are, there's only a few fiction works in here that I can see.
Yeah.
Not that those are bad, or I enjoy a good story for sure. In fact, maybe some of my favorites are those books. But the ones that give you insight into other things that you can apply to your day-to-day life, you can still find like a little bit of an escape.
Definitely.
Just kind of taking a step back and looking at those things. So I thought it was interesting when we decided last time that we were going to talk about books. I did a little bit of research because there was a few theoretical understandings that I brought from grad school that were kind of interesting to me. Just the, you remember you did your media fast this last semester. If you do you want to talk about that for a second, that might help preface what I'm about to say.
Okay. So for the communication class I took, we We were assigned to go on a media fast of 24 hours, which means no phone for 24 hours, mm-hmm. no like landline phone for 24 hours, no computer, internet, TV, radio. I mean, I didn't read during that time, I don't think either.
Would you have been allowed to?
I think so. It was basically screens.
Basically, okay.
Basically electronic screens, electronic media, essentially. We had to cut it out of our lives for 24 hours. And through doing that, we really learned just how much we're on it, mm-hmm. what it does to us, and just the sheer...
There's a book about it here, basically.
I'm in the middle of that book.
Yeah, I've seen. We'll talk about that one later. But the idea that I think books count as media as well.
Yeah, they're and a even form of media.
Going back to some ancient Greek philosophers when they were just beginning to start to write their things down. Mm-hmm. There's a play called Phaedrus, I believe. Phaedrus? I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but it's a play written by Plato. And the protagonist in the book, Socrates, exhibits some disdain towards written material because he was afraid that people, once they start to write their things down, mm-hmm. would start to lose their memories because, oh, I don't have to remember that because it's going to be written down.
I've heard of
and
that
so
before.
That was that was a big transition. I can't imagine what it would be like not to have written material. Just imagine the progress that humanity can make, even just scientifically or academically, just from being able to write things down and then being able to read what other people have written from before you. Mm-hmm. You don't actually have to be there present when someone says something.
Yeah.
Your words now can extend over a period of time.
For the rest of time, honestly.
Yeah. I think I remember from the same class that you took, the IPC, the interpersonal mm-hmm. communication, there was a story of a guy whose culture did not have any books or any writing.
Oh, yeah.
And just how much their culture focuses on narratives was just so interesting.
Yeah.
The idea that your words can live beyond just the present time was just such a foreign concept to him. He just didn't understand it, but he did understand stories from before. Yeah. So that was something interesting that I thought. And then, so each time we introduce a new kind of technology, whether it be writing or cell phones, how much that changes the way that we think about anything. There's this irreversible change. Mm-hmm. We can't imagine what it would be like not to have books, let alone not to have phones or TVs or the internet.
Yeah.
And I think that's a theory as well. The idea
of course
the medium is the message. Yep. Marshall McLuhan, it's like a media ecology, just that idea that every time something new is introduced into society, some mm-hmm. kind of technology that changes the way you communicate, it changes the way you think about that, and it's just an ongoing change. So that's I can see that from books, just how much that would change the way people thought back then, and that's maybe what Socrates or Plato writing as Socrates mm-hmm. Expressed in that play.
Yeah,
that there would be some pushback to that because I don't have to memorize all of this stuff. But back then, that's something that they would have had to do. If this
really
was
just
something that,
everything.
Yeah, if you talked about it, you had to know it front and back. Well, there wouldn't be a front and back to know it for. You just have to remember it. It's just be such a strange shift in the way that you process information.
Yeah. And we've definitely come across another. Wow, we've definitely come across another shift within the past 25 years.
Oh yeah,
to a new form of media mm-hmm. that almost has taken over books. I mean, if you think about it, bookstores and libraries they're not used as much now.
Yeah,
but there's something about holding a book and just getting the information from a piece of paper.
Yeah.
That I think is more satisfying than looking at a screen.
Oh, definitely. That's why I don't have a Kindle or...
Yeah, yeah.
That's why maybe I get tired of reading academic material more mm-hmm. is because I don't have the funding to print it off.
Yeah.
It'd be hundreds and hundreds of pages every week just mm-hmm. of this very dry but very informative academic stuff that...
Yeah.
I think I might be able to read it better. And I don't take notes either. I think maybe just because I started reading on the screen, just getting mm-hmm. all the PDFs. But do you note your books?
No, I've thought about it. I feel like I started doing it with one book, but then stopped. I haven't so far. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I don't either.
I almost really want to. So I can go back to a book and see certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, that's right. I highlighted a book. Was it Talk Like Ted? No. Was it? It was some... I don't know. I would highlight certain ideas. The book I was reading for the communication class to write a paper about. Storytelling.
Oh, okay.
The Secret of Storytelling. I would highlight things I thought were key points that I needed to remember for my paper and such.
The Storyteller's Secret.
Yep.
That's the one.
So... It depends what I'm reading for, what the purpose is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some books are just quick reads, and I could read it again to find everything out.
But yeah, I think I refrain from marking up my books.
Yeah, it's kind of nice to keep them pristine.
I like that the look of like a nice clean page. Yeah. But I don't think I would keep it that way because I want to sell it later. I probably won't ever sell a book.
No, I don't think so.
Just trying to keep expanding that library. Yeah. But I do have... like a photographic memory. So if
you do?
I remember,
why didn't I know that
page?
I don't. That explains so much.
Okay. So if I'm reading something in a book, and I've read it and I'm go along in my life, and then I come across a situation where I remember a certain part, the thing that triggers that memory in my brain is literally where it is on the page.
Really? Wow.
So. If you're talking to me about how, what's an example from one of these books?
Which one have you read?
Let's see. Like Reclaiming Conversation. Mm-hmm. So there's a part in there about, was it Louis C.K., the comedian?
Yes.
There's a quote from his appearance on a late night television show where he talks about the importance of solitude and not having your phones around you. And especially for children, and dealing with the emotions that come with being by yourself, and that includes sadness, but that's important to work through.
Yeah.
So that's kind of his speech. But I remember that because it starts on the bottom right-hand side of a page and extends down to the next page on the left about three-quarters of the way. Like, that's just how, I don't know. You can check me. It's at the beginning of the previous chapter. Yeah, that's how I remember it. I don't know how that happens, but that's just how I remember things.
See, and for me, I remember, like, key concept means idea. Like, if you said Louis C.K., like, I could remember that.
No, it's the previous chapter.
Oh my gosh, you're just gonna...
Yep. So, right here. So it starts on the bottom. Bottom right there, and extends about three-quarters of the way down to that page. Like, that's how I remember things.
I'm just kind of awestruck right now.
I thought this was how everyone remembered things for a while.
No.
I think there's a fancy German word for it, too, like Lokalgedächtnis.
Probably. There's a fancy, weird-sounding German word for just about everything.
Yeah, and they're all way too long.
They just keep adding words to each other.
They just make a whole sentence out of those.
Yeah. No, I wish I had that memory. Mm-hmm. The thing about books... Like, when I read a book, I want to transplant the knowledge of the author into my head.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's the purpose of books, is to get knowledge from one point to the other. And I hate when I forget things that I read then, because I put the time into this, I want to remember it. So when I read, I really try to take that in.
Yeah.
I don't just try to read to get through something. I really try to make the point to gain the knowledge the author wanted me to know, then kind of reflect about what I think about it, how I can apply it to music or school or anywhere else in my life, and just figure that out from there.
Do you ever skim books?
Not books I buy, really. Mm-hmm. If I skim, it'll be some academic material that I need to get done with.
Definitely
real fast.
Agree with that.
Yep. So the classic skimming and taking notes is always like reading the first paragraph, the first sentence of a paragraph.
Yeah.
Reading the last sentence of paragraph and just kind of going through something like that, which is actually a super easy way to get through some stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
I've had to do that multiple times.
If you're in a crunch, you can get through something very quickly. Or if you just don't want to put in that much effort, it's not required that you know something front and back, you can do it that way.
Yeah.
What's nice about academic material is it usually follows a very specific format. of like having an introduction and then a literature review and then maybe like a methods section where it outlines how the research was done and then a findings and then a discussion. So sometimes if I'm looking for material that can support something that I'm writing, I can use the headings that I need to find something that's on the right topic, and then I can skim to that part of the paper to see if that actually supports what I'm trying to say in my paper without having to read the entire thing. And then if I do end up using it, I usually do end up reading through almost all of it all the time, just to make sure that I know exactly what that author or that research was trying to accomplish or prove or show or find, and then I can use that appropriately. So that skimming is nice, or just reading the abstracts that come with those.
That's true.
Those are neat as well. It's a jacket version of a of a book for academic things, I think.
I do think most books on this table, though, like the type of books we read, have some sort of format, though. Like The Storyteller's Secret tells a story about the person who is good at telling stories. And then says what was in that story that makes them good, and then brings it down to like a tiny little paragraph of exactly the secret. And then Reclaiming Conversations is just kind of a bunch of like little vignettes almost to demonstrate
that point. Yeah, and it goes through Thoreau's three chairs. One for solitude, one for one-on-one conversation, and one for society, I think.
I haven't finished the book yet. And I haven't read it in a really long time.
Yeah, and I'm just starting to read it now, so so it's
No, that really helps, though, the when you read and you know what's coming up or how it will come up. I think that helps you get through. And just noticing that makes you a better reader, I think. Not saying I'm a better reader, but it's just saying it's a good thing to get in the habit of.
Yeah, that first chapter, look for those things that will give you sort of a roadmap for how the rest of it's going to go.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think we should get into some books.
Yeah, we have so many. I don't know if we're going to have
time. We're going to have to go pretty quick.
Yeah, we've got a little bit of time for this first segment here. So should we just start with the Reclaiming one?
Sure. Why don't you talk about it, because you're reading it right now.
Okay, so the idea of this book right here.
Who wrote it? Tell them who it
is. Sherry Turkle. Excuse me. I think she had a book that came before this that was dealing with the digital age idea that the way that our technology is sort of manifested in our culture is sort of inhibiting the development of empathy in children and even in adults. And so things like Facebook or just having your phone with you all the time fundamentally changes the way that we communicate with each other, which goes back to that media ecology theory by McLuhan, that the medium is the message. So why talk face-to-face and have an argument that way when you could just send a text? And this is a book that kind of goes further into that, and conversation is the thing that can cure a lot of those problems that happen because of a lack of empathy or a lack of development in children, or when you come across problems, or even just in the workplace. So I've only gotten a little bit into it, but I've loved what I've read so far. And again, I think it goes through the three chairs that Thoreau talks about, or hypotheticalizes. Is that even a word?
You've said that before.
I think I have, and I don't know if I'm proud of it or not, but it's...
We're going to have to go faster through all these. One last thing on this book, though, on Reclaiming. This is basically the first juror coming back about what phones are actually doing to us as a society. So maybe like 7 years ago, jury went out. Now they're starting to come back, and that's really cool.
Yeah. And so, even in preparing for this podcast, we put our phones right over there on the counter.
Yes, so that away from us.
Yeah, but even...
I heard it vibrate, and I was like...
See, just that. Even being over there, even turned off and silent, you can still... It changes the way that we're connected to others. Because you put that on, and you can see so many... Like, we could spend an entire episode talking about this.
We probably will eventually. So read books. Don't be on your phone all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Another good one, Talk Like Ted.
Talk Like Ted. This is so wonderful, by Carmine Gallo. Maybe someday I'll say his name right. I have no idea. But essentially, this is 9 things that TED Talk speakers do or should do in preparation for their TED Talk, and it is wonderful for business talks. I think all college students should read this for presentations they have to give in class, because I've seen so many awful presentations. I went through two of them today. I was just like, this is boring. I'm going to use what I learned in Talk Like TED.
Yeah.
And then completely change what I do. Basically, how to engage people, how to keep their attention for 18 minutes.
And this is another one that I think we could, of the books that we have here, that we could, especially with this podcast, talk about quite at length.
Definitely.
Because we reference TED Talks all the time.
We really do.
And there's maybe some people have this idea that, you know, presentations are kind of getting outdated when when you're like in front of an audience because of the way technology is developing. And you just have to watch any one of these TED Talks that people have online to realize just how powerful a great speech or a great presentation can be.
Yeah.
And this goes through what makes those clocks tick, so to speak.
Definitely.
So
next book. Haven't read this book yet, but this is Elon Musk by Ashley Vance. So this is biography on the man Elon Musk behind Tesla. He co-founded PayPal.
Okay, yeah, and that's
then
where he
got bought out by eBay. Used that money to start up Tesla, SpaceX, and he has one other startup. I don't know. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm doing a paper on Elon Musk, so I bought a book.
Yep.
Because I'm super into that right now.
Yeah, he's one of the most visionary people that I can think of in our time, at least.
Like, he's looking out for the human race as a whole, saying, where are we going next? And he's doing things about it. Like,
saying, 40 years, we're going to be on Mars.
Yeah, and he actually has an actual plan to do it.
I might actually be alive for that. That's incredible.
This is one of the things I'm most excited for in my life, actually.
Is the first landing on Mars?
Yeah. And just, he wants to make that accessible to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
How crazy is that? He wants to make humans a multiplanetary species.
Yeah.
What?
The idea of, even just having rockets that can be reused.
Yeah, they can land rockets now, vertically.
And I remember that happened very recently.
Yeah.
The first one actually landed.
Ago.
And then one exploded, but it was just a... Three exploded. That's three. That's three more than I thought.
Two more than you thought.
Yeah, three times, I don't know. Math is never my strong suit.
Anyway, Elon Musk, cool dude.
Yeah. Hopefully I can read that book at some point as well.
Yeah, I'll get through it and then you'll have to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Here, quick break from just going through these books. Sharing books, I think, is one of the coolest things.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you share a book with someone and you've read the book, you're like, I have this information and I care about you enough that I want you to have this.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so cool because I think... Like, when you read something, it kind of becomes a part of you. Or like, you take on what the book meant to you and such, and just sharing that with someone is super important.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually kind of transitions into the next book I have.
All right.
One day on a vlog, I post Instagram stories. It's kind of like a vlog every day. I was talking about creatives and how terrifying it is to honestly just be a creative and exist in that world and still figure out how to live in the world and get paid and just kind of, you know, succeed.
Elizabeth Gilbert is the author of this one.
Yeah, and so another person, Tara Schuff, awesome photographer, suggested this book to me, Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert.
I recall a TED Talk that she gave.
Yeah, she's also the author of Eat, Pray, Love. I think the TED Talk was about that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was her experience writing that book.
Yeah. So I'm really excited to read this. Curious what it will do to apply to my life.
Mm-hmm.
Creative Living Beyond Fear is the subtitle in here.
I think one of the interesting things I recall from just her talk was the idea of kind of harkening back to ancient ideas of the genius is this external thing that gives you inspiration, like a muse.
Mm-hmm.
And I can definitely relate to that because I have no idea where my creative thoughts come from.
Yeah.
What is going on? It's just there. I don't know, like the music I hear in my head before I write it down that happens when no other music is playing. Where is that coming from?
Yeah, I
have
that.
No idea.
I love
and
that.
Then she goes to, some people will even have like strategies to write those things down. Like someone will hear a poem go in their head and they'll literally pull it back through their head, like visualizing it, like these words on a string that like go from in between their ears and comes out and they like
metaphorically pull that back and write their poem backwards because that's how they heard it in their head. Things like that was just fascinating to me to listen to. So that's another one that would...
This is going to be a good book.
Very interesting to read.
Thank you to Tarisha for suggesting this. Cause
very artsy cover as well.
Yes, it is. Creative cover. Here's back to the communications again. I haven't read this book, but...
And this is one that I have not heard of before.
So. Really? Here's how this book came into my life. I went to reading in the content area. Huh. Doesn't that sound like an exciting class?
It was.
Yeah, it actually was. The teacher of that, Professor Paul Grubbs, is an incredible person. I respect that man so much.
I learned more about how to teach math in that class than I think all of my other math classes.
Yeah, he's so cool and just super passionate and gets, like, hard topics that you might not think apply to you to apply to you, and then you remember them. So when he mentions this book in a keynote, I go online in his class and buy the book and have it shipped. So within 10 minutes of him mentioning this, I was on the way to New Ulm. So What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Shallows by Nicholas Carr. I don't know what the internet is doing to our brains yet. It's been mentioned in Reclaiming Conversation, but we'll see what Nicholas Carr has to say now.
Yeah.
The back... Widely... No, that's not even...
There's a lot of quotes on this one that are one word.
Yep.
Eloquent. Riveting. Rewarding.
A book everyone should read.
So. Revelatory.
Yeah. Provocative by the Boston Globe. So, I'm excited to read this. Mm-hmm. I think it will greatly apply to any mass media thing I produce. Just figuring out what the internet is doing to our brains and then kind of decode that and figure out how to purposely affect brains in a good way and how videos can do that and how other sorts of media can do that. So
it'd be interesting if it goes into maybe the neuroscience behind how our brains are wired to...
I have no idea if it will.
I don't know. So. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's an exciting one. This one, also good. The Storyteller's Secret. Why don't you talk about this one a bit? You haven't read this one.
I haven't read
this one. Oh, never mind.
I've read the one by Carmine Gallo.
Yeah.
The one Talk Like Ted, but this one was the one that I think you might have some highlights in.
Yeah, this is the one I highlighted. So I wrote a paper on storytelling for interpersonal communications class, and I read this book to go along with it, and it was really fantastic. It was a bunch of stories about storytellers. who figured out how stories can greatly affect business. So it was mostly aimed at business. And
I noticed that when I was reading Talk Like Ted, it was aimed towards that.
Yeah.
Maybe executive.
From TED speakers to business legends. So it's it's mainly that, but applications everywhere. I think education applications, huge. I think stories need to be utilized more often. That presentation I gave today, I gave a presentation on motivation in the music classroom.
Okay.
And like how to motivate middle schoolers to do music and stuff. So I read this article and I was just supposed to present on this one article and what I found. And it was just a bunch of research. I didn't want to talk about research. So all what I did, I took the research and I applied it to all these stories I've had from my life and all these different people. So I just told their stories.
How long was your presentation?
It was supposed to be 7 to 10 minutes and I think it ended up being 12. But
I think it's hard to narrow down at this level, like with good stories and presentations, especially watching TED talks so much, you just get a feel for that 17 minute presentation.
So, no, it went really well though. Like I had the class's engagement the entire time because I was using stories rather than just data. facts, data,
numbers.
So that's a big part of the Storyteller's Secret is telling stories.
And I think storytelling, maybe to segue into this next book, is an essential component of being able to teach, motivate, coach, whatever it is. Being able to tell a story is the quintessential thing that that will ultimately, I believe, lead towards some sort of success or at least an improvement on something.
Definitely.
And so this semester I'm conducting an independent study
on stories. Mm-hmm. And in the academic world, that is known as rhetorical criticism. So this is the textbook that I'm working through for, as one of the books that I'm going through on my own for this class, by Sonia Foss, recommended to me by actually a professor of the IPC class that you were in last semester.
Yeah.
Dr. Mark Pauschen.
He says hi, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I talked to him today.
Oh, cool.
He says hi.
Well, Dr. Pauschen's great guy, if you ever get a chance to meet him. One of the most influential humans that I've ever met in my life.
He's becoming that for me, too.
Yeah. He recommended this book to me. It's actually very intriguing. Just the ability to look at a text or a story or a film or a song or whatever it may be, a speech. And it just goes through different ways that you can break that down and analyze it to figure out what makes it work.
Yeah.
So I've only made it through a few chapters so far. One of them only applied to speeches, which going back to TED Talks is kind of interesting. Yeah. It's kind of the neo-Aristotelian criticism. Just looks at how rhetors use speeches to influence a crowd or the people who are listening. The next one is a, I believe it's cluster criticism, from Kenneth Burke. He's a really influential rhetorical critic, literary critic, communication scholar, what have you, a sociologist.
What other theory does he have?
He has a pentadic criticism, I think, is coming up later, and there's also one about identity.
Ah,
the
yes.
idea that what makes identity you, what makes you connect with other people is sharing a common ground.
Yes.
Like, oh, I thought that you were the only one, and then like you share a bond about something that you both are passionate about. And C.S. Lewis also has a similar ideas about friendship and identity and things like that.
We'll
so this book. It was really great. Hopefully I can start working through it more once I get my thesis solidly on the road.
Yeah.
Cluster criticism, the one I'm in right now, is looking at in a text or whatever you're analyzing, you look for the key terms or key figures. So you can even look at like, a picture, like an art, and notice something that comes up all the time is squares or a certain color or a certain figure. And then after you identify those key things or key words in a text, you look at the words that surround it or the figures that surround it or the sounds that surround it, whatever you're looking at. And those things will help reveal something about the person who made it or what they were trying to get across that might not have been noticeable before.
Okay.
So they looked at, I think, the Enron Book of Ethics was one of the papers I read.
All right.
I looked at this, and Enron was one of these. Yeah, it just sounds really random, but I think Enron, to give a little backstory, was a, what was it? Some kind of company that worked, with equity or home owning or something. But what happened was the company was very, very corrupt, and they did not have many ethics at all. Mm. And so the ethics book almost became sort of like a meme or like a thing to look at from the outside, like, oh, look at the ethics book for this company, which had no ethics. And they looked through it, and they found out a lot of things about what the company thought about ethics. Usually ethics gives you like a guide for what you ought to do. Whereas their book of ethics was more prohibitive.
Oh.
So the things that surrounded terms like the company or just, I don't know. It's very interesting stuff, and I can't wait to go through more of it. So.
Yeah. This is a book I had in my room, but only you can talk about so far.
Oh, yeah. So this is a book, Theories of Human Communication, is probably, like this one, an introductory textbook to just the field of communication as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So it follows, I believe, Craig's meta-theoretical framework for what theories are like,
right.
How they fit in with one another, where they come from. So he identifies different places in academia where a theory might have spawned from. So like sociology, where there might be one with phenomenology. Theories that come out of these traditions and then how they interrelate to each other on a scale of like the message, the communicator, the conversation, the relationship, and you take these things up and higher until you get to like groups and culture as a whole.
Yeah.
And so you kind of make the matrix from these traditions and these levels of communication, and you can fit theories in there. Hmm. And then it goes through all of the different theories. So he's got, I think, was it Little John and Foss? I don't know if the Karen Foss and Sonia Foss are related. I wouldn't be surprised. Both great writers.
It'd be interesting.
From what I've seen so far. But a lot of what I know about communication can be found in here, at least.
Interesting.
So these are both books that come mainly from my grad school experience. Mm-hmm. Maybe not something you'd find in like a Barnes and Noble, but
yeah, whereas mine were all Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, most of my books come from Amazon, and I learned a lot from these. And if you're interested in any kind of theory or communication or stories in general, I think these would be really excellent sources from the academic realm that would give you insight to the things that we talk about, at least on this podcast. So
definitely,
that's enough of that kind of stuff.
Okay, here we go. Completely different. This book I got in sophomore year of high school. The Great Pretender, Theo Janssen,
Theo.
Because
is this the guy that made
Norwegian, Swedish, something like that?
He's an artist, right?
Yeah.
Does he make the sculptures that like move on their own?
Yeah, Strandbys.
Okay, yeah. So
this I love this book. So this is all about his Strandbys. These kinetic sculptures that he puts on the beach, and they just move using the wind, and they're made out of PVC bottles he finds laying around, and they're so grounded in physics and mechanics, and it's just so cool. So like, if you're watching the video, like, there's this picture of it, and I don't know how to describe this, but Strandbys.
It's
crazy.
A scaffolded house on wheels with wind sails on top, and
yeah, so it's just absolutely incredible.
And I think you can find the videos of these things online.
Yeah,
they just look incredible.
Yeah, so I did a paper on this in sophomore year of high school, and I was supposed to find like three sources for it, and this was like the only book on it. So bought the book. Expensive book, worth it. I just think this stuff is so cool. Because it's creative, it's mechanical. Back in sophomore year of high school, I still wanted to be an engineer. Mm-hmm. And I still think that stuff is interesting. So, just to see what he does with...
There's even a CD run.
Yeah, good thing I don't have a CD player.
Or a DVD.
Or a DVD player. Just to see what he can do with PVC as an artist and as a mechanic. And engineer, really.
Maybe another super example awesome. Of how constraining yourself to a certain material when building something can yield some incredible results.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd suggest this book. It's just really cool.
Wow.
I'm such a nerd about this.
I don't know. It's a good thing. Everyone's a nerd for something.
Oh, it's so true. I just talked about it with Dr. Potion, actually.
Really?
How great it is to be a geek or a nerd.
Yeah. All right, so that's stack one books.
Isn't even all the books that.
Oh no, we had to be
very, have or love.
Very selective in the ones that that we chose for this. So this one right here is maybe one of my favorites of all time, and this is one of the few books in here that is fiction. It's called "Till We Have Faces" by C.S. Lewis, and it's based off of a myth from it's ancient Rome or Greek.
I can't remember. I read it.
Let's see if I can find on the back. Oh, Cupid and Psyche.
Oh,
I think that's Roman. Not sure. It's been too long since I've studied mythology, mm-hmm. but it retells the myth, and it goes through the eyes of this girl whose sister marries Cupid, basically. Mm. And she has to deal with feelings of jealousy, feelings of guilt, feelings of frustration. She becomes the queen of the place where she's from, but her sister gets taken away from her, and she kind of becomes mad at the gods for this and has to confront them. And in doing so, she ends up confronting herself as well. So very good book. I remember...
I should read that.
Yeah, this one is a very good, very easy read,
mm-hmm.
or a very quick read. I think mostly because I just got pulled right into it, especially after the first.
Because it's a story.
Yeah, you just get sucked right in. So, Unlike the other books that I read, this one I wasn't able to read just chapter by chapter. Yeah. I just went right through. I couldn't put it down.
Should we do the rest of the C.S. Lewis? I think we have some other C.S. Lewis books.
Okay, let's see if I find...
Well, let's not put another book on top of that.
Okay, so this one is The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. What should I say about this one?
I haven't read that one yet either.
So this one is about a guy who dies and he finds himself in this strange place where everything is super hard, I think.
Like
literally the grass is like shards. Okay. It's really difficult to tread.
Okay.
And there's a destination far away that's some sort of like heaven-esque thing, and you get a person from that place that comes and becomes like your mentor, and everyone goes through like a certain struggle to end up going to this place. And I mean, it's been too long since I've read this book, so I'm probably not doing it justice, but I think I read it in like 2 hours. It's a very very quick one,
small book.
A lot of interesting little vignettes about things that he observes in others as they're trying to go through their struggles. And then a nice little twist at the end. So, C.S. Lewis.
Well, I have to read that.
Last C.S. Lewis book we have here, Mere Christianity. I haven't read this book yet, but my friend was reading it and let me read like a chapter, and I was hooked. He just has some great things to say about Christianity and being a Christian. I'm super curious. And really interested to see how that honestly plays into society today, with basically bans on religions coming into the United States, and just who's in charge and stuff, and where Christianity exists in the world right now. So I'm really curious. I think it'll be a good read. I love the cover on this book. This jacket is just beautiful.
And we had to be very selective about which C.S. Lewis books we even let into this pile.
Because,
I mean, there's another one I'm reading right now called On Stories, which is more his work as a literary critic, analyzing stories and figuring out what makes them work. At the same time as he's writing all of these ones himself. So,
super awesome. That's enough C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
Well done. Okay. What do you want to talk about next?
Oh, boy.
Let's get through this one quick.
Okay, very quick one.
Steal Like an Artist, Austin Kleon. Excellent book. Teaches you how to unlock your creativity by looking at the work of others and then learning from that while respecting what others have done in the past.
So it's not copying or plagiarizing. It's using others as an influence in a way that's highly creative and respectable.
Yeah.
Nothing new under the sun.
No.
It's in scripture and it's in everyday life. Like, there's nothing new. Everything's a remix. There's a TED Talk about that, right?
There's
like,
countless things out there.
It's just really intriguing that all creative work has some sort of inspiration or or story.
So,
read it.
Quick hour read.
Oh, yeah.
Super fast.
This is when I blocked out. I forced myself to
just sit down and
just sit down and just do one of the little chapters at a time. It's just like a couple pages, a couple paragraphs, and
it's basically 10 great points.
Yeah.
So, huge creative book. Read this. It's awesome.
On the same note, The War of Art.
See, I need to read this too. You heard about this. We heard about this in another podcast.
Yeah, right? Another podcast is the only other podcast I've listened to. Other than this, I actually don't even listen to our podcast, to be honest with you. Just when
I don't want to listen to this.
I don't know either. I'm kind of scared about it. But no, I listened to a podcast by Jason Jagard. He was the one who was being interviewed. And it was by Story Gathering is the conference that
we
has
need
a podcast.
To go to.
Yeah, it's a conference about stories and storytelling and all sorts of the wonderful things that can come as a result of that. And so I saw this podcast there, and I don't know what it was about it that drew me into that specific podcast, but Jason Jagard is becoming one of my favorite people to listen to, as even just the few things that I've heard, like the speech he gave at Story Gathering is on Vimeo now. Very, very good.
Insightful. And analytical.
So I don't know, if I could work for anyone, I think I would work for him. Novus Global or any of this Spark Good is he one is great
great guy. I haven't heard anything I didn't like, but he talked about this book, The War of Art, and by Stephen Pressfield. Break through the blocks and win your inner creative battles. So he kind of sets it up as a struggle. And I think that's something that not many creative people realize or expect, is that the people who are putting out great content consistently and daily even, they have a rigorous schedule that they have to keep up.
Yeah.
And so really people ask, like, do you only write when you're inspired to write? And someone would be like, yeah. But thankfully, I get inspired to write every morning at 9 a.m. That's just the way they are. Yeah. That's what you have to do. You have to force yourself through that and choose which of the voices in your head you listen to. Mm-hmm. Maybe less schizophrenic way of saying that inside this book, but very good. I actually couldn't sit down and read this just one chapter at a time, because most of the chapters are like a page long. There's three separate books, and there's just a little point on each page with like a paragraph or two about it.
Nice.
So it goes through a lot of different things. And if you're a creative person, or if you struggle with even just writer's block academically, I think this is a great one to look through. So
sweet.
All right. So the next books that I want to talk about are by Daniel Goleman, and they're called Emotional Intelligence, and there's the one after that is Social Intelligence. I think they go hand in hand. He's a neuroscientist, and he's looking at kind of going along with Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, mm-hmm. the idea that being aware of your emotions and being able to use them appropriately is a skill
powerful.
That can be something labeled as intelligence, why it's more important than IQ, literally on the cover there.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting about this, or his work, is that he goes through from a neuroscience perspective, like what's going on, literally going on in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like the high road, the things that you're very conscious of, and the low road, the things that are very unconscious. So one of the interesting stories from that book, I don't know if I've mentioned it on the podcast before, is there was a guy who had an accident that severed part of his ocular nerve, in between
optic.
His optic, thanks, goodness gracious. His optic nerve was severed, part of it at least. And he found that when he was going into rooms, such as like someone was on their deathbed, he could like had a feel for what the mood in the room was.
Yes.
It was just super weird. And they put him in an fMRI machine so they can measure where his brain waves are going and everything as it's happening. And they would put faces in front of him with certain expressions. So someone could be like angry or upset or happy or joyful. Mm-hmm. And he was able to, for the most part, like recognize what these emotions are, because the part of the nerve that went from his eyes to his brain that registered things like emotion wasn't gone completely.
I didn't even know there was that part of the nerve.
I didn't even know this. I don't know exactly how it separated, but the idea is he's blind. He cannot see,
but he can still pick up
emotions off of people's faces.
Wow.
And so that just shows that the mind is working at levels that we do not even comprehend right now.
Yeah.
And so he goes through some of the neuroscience behind that.
That's awesome.
Another story that I think deserves mention, maybe I've also mentioned it on the podcast as well, is that he recalls a time when he was a child and it would snow on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And to go out to the playground in recess, usually if there's a path, you take it, right? So if he was the first kid out there, he would take like a zigzag path. But all the kids would follow him because it's the path of least resistance. But the path
of
least resistance isn't the path of shortest distance. So that is kind of an analogy for how our brains can wire things. Like if the path of least resistance for our brain is to respond in an angry or upset way, or to go through socialization or our emotions in ways that are unhealthy, that might just be the quickest way for our brain to react to something.
Interesting.
It might not be the optimal way for something to go about. So both very interesting.
Yeah, I have to read
kind of academic-y, but It's
very applicable.
Very applicable to your day-to-day life, and very eye-opening for me, at least. I think I read this as part of the IPC class that we talked about.
Yeah, he talked about that. I remember him talking about both these books in that class, mm-hmm. holding it up, and I was like, I've seen that somewhere, and it was at your house. This one.
This is, I won't go in very much about this. This is Mind, Self, and Society. It's basically the collection of thoughts by George Herbert Mead, G.H. Mead. He's the, I suppose, father of symbolic interactionism, which is my favorite theory, I think. I don't know if it's fair to say.
It used to be.
I'm using it for my thesis, and it's kind of an all-encompassing theory in my mind. Just the idea that we get an identity of ourselves through others that we view around us. Yeah. So we have that sort of, we're inside a society, and when we do things or say things, what we interpret others reacting to will let us develop a sense of identity, things like that. So I'm looking at that kind of idea in the classroom. Very, very,
very academic.
Very, very academic, especially since it was written in, I believe, the 30s. So Mead didn't actually write this book. It's a compilation of his notes. All of his followers or students at the time in the Chicago school that he was at kind of collected those things after he had died and published them in this book. So
cool.
I'm working through it. It's very, very, very thick and very wordy, but interesting nonetheless, at least for me.
That's a
passion. So,
passion of mine. This book, Musicophilia, by Oliver Sacks. Getting back to neuroscience, before. This book is a collection of stories, tales of the music and brain, as it says here on the cover. It talks about, well, how about I just, this story. It starts off with this story of a man, real story, who was just walking down the road one night, noticed thunderclouds start coming in, gets struck by lightning, okay? He has this, like, out-of-body experience that he can remember where he saw himself get struck by lightning. And just laying there and thought he was dead.
Interesting.
So he, in his mind, was seeing this as an onlooker. He was seeing himself as an onlooker, okay? But then, all of a sudden, just like a rush of ocean, I forget the analogy they use, but he just all of a sudden went back into his body and he was awake again. He survived getting struck by lightning, which, one, what? huge. And then after that, all of a sudden he has an inkling for classical music and piano. And there's other stories of people having these crazy experiences and then all of a sudden are really good at piano or understand jazz or just all these crazy things. And it's people who, like, wholeheartedly did not listen to piano music and now cannot stop playing it, and it's driving people in their lives mad because of how much it's happening. And it's really cool for me. I think it's a great read for any music educator out there, anyone who likes music. Because it's not the stuff you're normally going to hear.
So, like, crazy experiences that turn people into virtuosos, basically.
Yeah, yeah, basically.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and then it also gets into kind of how music can be used as therapy and things like that. There's another story of a man who was getting Alzheimer's. He couldn't remember how to go places besides muscle memory. He couldn't tell you, like, how to walk from the living room to the bathroom. He could do it because of his muscle memory, but he had no idea how.
Okay.
So he's completely losing everything, doesn't even recognize his wife, but can remember music and things like that, and can remember how to play certain things and how to sing things. And
I've seen videos, too, where people play music from their childhood or someone with Alzheimer's, and they light up.
Yeah.
And then for the time afterwards, they're almost completely competent. They recognize people. It's just amazing the power that music has.
Yeah. So this book is great. Kind of proves that music is just a phenomenon of humans. Yep. Every human has the capacity for music. It's so cool.
I think I remember a House episode. Back when I was in high school, I watched a lot of House.
Really?
With my roommate at the time. And there's a virtuoso piano player who had a brain problem. And I think it wasn't a lobotomy, but they had to sever part of his brain, the connection between
his left and right side of the brain. So before, he couldn't even button up his shirt, but he was a virtuoso on the piano. And then afterwards, he couldn't play the piano, but he could button up his shirt again. Oh, it was just a weird... that is some random memory of an episode. So,
but yeah, no, great music book. Fun to read. Oliver Sacks, cool guy.
This is a book by Cy Montgomery. It's called The Soul of an Octopus. And it's about the soul of an octopus. No, it's, it's kind of an exploration of consciousness.
You could say a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness.
So I heard about this book through one of my personality theory classes. It's just exploring consciousness, and I heard about it in one of her online lectures. And I was one of those things where as I was listening to the lecture, I go on Amazon and find out, oh, this book's only $10. I'm going to get that. And so I got it, and it apparently octopi are incredible.
Wait, is it octopodes?
I don't even know.
Oh.
Multiple? I can't even say that. An octopus is a very intriguing creature. They're like aliens. They're like this.
They can camouflage themselves.
They can camouflage themselves. They can squeeze themselves into a different... Yeah. They can recognize people.
They can unscrew things.
They can not like people. They can like spit water at people they don't like.
They can spit ink at people.
They can escape from the aquarium. They can...
They can kill someone, sure.
Yeah, they can like... They have like suction cups on their...
Everything.
Leg. They can fit through tiny spaces, and they're just...
If anything is an alien, it's an octopus.
This is probably first contact. Is my idea. This is what's happening. There's a movie called Life that's coming out about... Like aliens and
like from another,
it's probably the same planet that octopuses kind of came from. That's my guess.
What's the book about?
The book is literally about just octopi and exploring how the writer's experiences with an octopus or multiple octopi. I'm really just butchering the plural of sounds off. His experiences with these things kind of helped him explore his own ideas of consciousness. And I've only gotten through a chapter or two of this one. It's one of the ones that's next on my list to finish. Speaking of books I just finished, yours, that last one that you want to talk about.
And the first one that I ever really bought, Creative Schools by Ken Robinson. Kind of tying everything all together, Ken Robinson gave a TED Talk about are schools killing creativity? And I'm sure we've talked about that.
Yes. Yeah. Our education episode, for sure.
Yes. So I said, I want to know more about this guy. Found out about this book and just dove in. And the book... and himself provides some great examples of schools doing wonderfully creative things and educating students not to attest but to remember things and to become valuable citizens in society creatively. And it's honestly really awesome. Also gives some bad examples, things not to do. Cites some great education resources and
a lot of experiences.
He's never been a teacher, actually.
Yeah.
But he's served on multiple education committees in districts, in governments, around the world.
He's from the UK, and I think he moved to America, California afterwards. But just kind of centering around student-centered education.
Yeah.
Just going back to what's important to these students.
Yeah.
What's important for your kids as the future generations of whatever country you're in.
Yeah.
And kind of going back to the roots of that. He's a very interesting insights into why the public school system is the way it is today.
Yes,
so
very true.
Coming out of the Industrial Revolution, we needed more people to be literate and more people to do higher skilled jobs. And just the way the system is now is just like it's designed like a factory to just produce a ton of people who can do the same things. And that's not what our society needs at this time.
Yeah.
So very, very insightful. I learned a lot. Don't know if I'm going to be a teacher, but regardless, what useful information wherever you end up, you're always going to be able to influence those around you when you know the things like that.
So the last book I want to talk about is
Drive to Win The Essential Guide to Race Driving by Carol Smith.
It's not a joke.
It's not even a joke.
It's a real book.
I remember when
and you've
I was.
Read it.
I have. I've read it in detail. This goes into the tire dynamics and the way you can like go about testing on a track. Like, if I could be anything in the world, I think I'd be a race car driver. And it's been like that since I was like a little kid. And I looked up books on how to drive race cars, and this is one that the first time I read it, I got it through the like the snail mail library system, like before they had like the internet thing.
Really?
Like, you like I found the book in the catalog for another library that was in my hometown library, and I was like, I want that. And so I got it sent there and I got to read it. And then recently, about 2 years ago, I bought it online because it was on sale. And it's really helpful for the race simulation stuff that I do.
Yeah.
Which I'm not doing as much of nowadays, unfortunately.
But John won a race on there. You're ranked in the world.
I'm not good at this.
John is really good at this. He's humble about it, but he's really good at
this. I'm okay at it. I'm not in the bottom tier, but it's...
In comparison, when we race against each other, well, not against each other, but practice on the mm-hmm. same thing, John will actually complete a lap and finish a race. I will crash at least 15 times in my life.
you were learning quite a bit, I think.
I should read this book and learn a lot more.
Yeah, you could. So this is maybe a little humor to end up our episode, but do you have any takeaways? Any last thoughts?
So the thing about this, not even all these books are about creativity.
Yeah.
But like, how can you apply basically everything to creativity or mm-hmm. producing content or communication? And I think the thing is just gathering knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be open to finding out what other people have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people are really awesome and write down everything they say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called a book. And so that's just honestly the biggest takeaway, is to be constantly gathering information. I think books are a great way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It sets you apart a little bit from, because I think a lot of people have given up on books. But I think it's a great thing to do. In a talk we both went to by Dr. Bauschen.
Oh, none other than.
Well, it's like sixth time he's come up.
Yeah.
He was talking about how his doctoral classes mm-hmm. were, and this girl that was in that class, and it was like the first day or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's just sitting there, and there's all these professors who are going to be teaching them their doctoral classes, and she's sitting there. It's just books. It's just books. It's just books. And basically her point was the professors have just read more books than all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a grain of truth to that.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the biggest takeaways I had from at least that presentation, was the idea that once you get up to the capacity for reading and writing content, at least academically, just read a lot and write a lot more. And once you get up to that pace, that's pretty much how you learn. And I've noticed that too. That's maybe my takeaway, is that most of my learning now comes through reading something, whether it be online, whether it be academic material, whether it be a textbook, whether it be a story by C.S. Lewis or someone else, or just there's always something that you can take away from a book.
Yeah.
You always kind of push that boundary of what you know, understand, or don't know and don't understand a little bit further. So, yeah. I think that just about wraps up books.
Yeah.
Actually, I think we just scratched the surface.
We definitely... I mean, this is just what we're interested
in. I'd really love
right
to go
now.
Into this Drive to Win book a lot more. No, I'm just kidding. Next week, we are planning on talking about...
influences. Yes, influences.
And you might have a little teaser for that.
Yeah, a web of influence, I found out, is a really awesome thing you can make, and just kind of helps you gain insight into your life and why you are the person you are today.
Yeah.
And I think that everyone should do that.
And you have a little story that goes about, or tells the story of how you came across that spirit, or web of influences, and why you made it, and the things that led up to that.
I'm really excited.
You will have to tune in next week, because we have gone way too long, I feel.
This has been a long one.
Yeah.
But thanks for sticking with us. This has been John.
And John.
And you're watching the 226.
Thanks for listening.
Peace.